Good morning. It's good that you're all here. I arranged this morning to have the wind as my accompaniment, and the wind does not come cheap, so I hope you appreciate. This morning I will be talking about another practice instruction from the Zen Master Hongzhe. My last two talks, I think, my last two Sunday talks, have been about the very first practice instruction. And he's still really just alive in me, so I'm going to continue talking about his practice instruction today. This one comes from a little bit later in the collection. And for those of you who are new here, Hongzhe is a Chinese Zen master in our lineage, lived during the 1100s. So all of this would have been practiced and lived and written about 900 years ago, I guess. He had a very powerful influence on Ehe Dogen, who is our Soto Zen founder in Japan. And we practice here in the spirit of Dogen, so Hongzhe's voice is kind of alive here as well. So the piece is called Buddha Flowers, Leaves, Roots, and Dusts. And it's on the front of your program for those of you who have one. And if you don't, you can just sort of follow along. And I thought it might be nice to just say this aloud, all of us. We can just kind of recite it together. How does that sound? So, it reads, "The way is not what the ancestors transmit. Before the ancestors came, it already pervades the whole environment. Emptiness is inherently without characteristics. Spirituality cannot be imitated. On its own, illumination emerges from causes and conditions. Constantly living apart from surface appearances is called being the ancestor. Simply certify and unite with it. You cannot be handed it. All Buddhas arrive here and regard this as the ultimate. They respond to transformations and disperse their bodies as flowers, leaves, roots, and dusts. Wisdom enters the three times, and the 10,000 changes do not disturb us. Each dust is not outside us. This marvel is beyond the vast thousands of classical texts. So where could you hold on to the shadowy world?" Thank you. So I'm talking about this today because recently I was on a I was on an 8-day meditation retreat up north of here in Collegeville, at the House of Prayer, and the one book I brought with me, they're not quite as strict about reading during retreats as we are here, so I brought myself a book, and I thought, oh, I'll read some Hongzhe during this retreat for a few minutes every night before I go to bed. And I just opened, the book, by the way, is Cultivating the Empty Field, translated by Taigen Dan Layton, so in case you're interested. So I kind of picked it up randomly and thought I'll just open to any one of these practice instructions. And this is the first one I read that first night. And I got as far as the first two lines and went, oh, man, that's fabulous. That's enough for me tonight. And so the second night I read the first two lines and went, wow, fabulous. That's enough for me tonight. So anyway, I spent 8 nights reading the first two lines. You know, it's funny, I actually realized that, you know, we've, for the most part, most of us anyway, have been trained to take in information, especially reading, we're trained to read in a very specific way. We read for information. So I kind of want to know, okay, that's a cool long paragraph. What's the takeaway? Like, can you give me the Cliff's Notes or the bullet point, you know, the elevator speech, whatever we call it? Because we're so used to just taking in facts. I can add them to my repertoire. I can memorize them. I can tell them to you later. That means I know them. And this type of piece, you can see already, even if you've never read this, it won't be read that way. It just defies being read that way. Dogen strikes me as very much the same way. It reads a lot more like poetry than it does factual prose. So it actually sounds silly, and it is silly, of course, that I spent 8 nights reading 2 sentences. But that's the way this sort of wants to be read, I think. This really isn't the type of thing that is written to be taken in as information. I think we read this for transformation. So we sort of just, I don't know what you do. You let it roll through you. You store it in your heart. You let it kind of rumble around and do what it is it's going to do. So I invite you to do that. I'm going to just touch the surface this morning of this piece, and we'll see how far we get. But it's a beautiful piece, and that really is the way that I think it lends itself to being read. It lends itself to being chanted. It lends itself to being read over and over, and just sort of let it thump around in you. So we'll start with those first 2 lines that I love so much. The way is not what the ancestors transmit. Before the ancestors come, it already pervades the whole environment. Well, I guess like all good writers, he really grabs our attention with the first line because that's the direct opposite of everything we're taught. Like the way, you know, the path, the Buddhist path, the Buddha Dharma, the whatever, the way is what the ancestors give us, right? That's our teachers, that's their teachers, that's their teachers' teachers, going all the way back to the Buddha. He taught a path. He taught a way. That's what he transmits to us. That's what our teachers have transmitted. So, oh yes, that's what they transmit. If someone were to ask me, what did you know, Tim teach you, I'd say, oh, well, the way. He tried as hard as he could to teach me the way, to transmit to me the way. So he starts by saying, the way is not what the ancestors transmit. Before the ancestors come, it already pervades the whole environment. So we learn that the way is not contained in Zen or Buddhism or churches or families or marriage or children or jobs or breathing or anything. The way is inherently uncontained. It is boundaryless. And so his tense, the way he's using tenses, and this would be Tigan's choice in his translation, but the way he's using tenses here is really important. Before the ancestors come, it already pervades. So that's bad grammar. Right? Because, well, before you came, it pervaded would be past tense, right? Before you came, past tense, it already pervaded, past tense. Because we think of the ancestors as people who came before us, right, in linear time. No. He's just taking that away. Before the ancestors come, present tense, it already pervades. This is his way of reconnecting us. This is it. Please come back. It is now. This is the moment that is uncontained. Right, the way isn't separate from the moment, and the moment is uncontained and boundaryless. So whatever umbrella we put it under, whatever label we attach to it, Zen, Buddhism, ancestors, breath, families, it includes all those things and yet always points beyond them. It always contains an infinite amount more than those things. So this is the moment. And if you can find another moment, I'd love to hear about it. In fact, if you can find the edges of this moment? I'd love to know about it. You know, the boundaries? Can you find them? So the way is always before the ancestors and the transmission. It is always after them. And it's always inside of these things. So he's really... he's really just exploding the idea that all of this is finite and concrete and takes place in linear time, and there's a thing, there's a set of knowledge or verses or practices or things that just passed and passed and passed and passed. Yes, all those things are true too, but he's immediately taking us beyond those things. Please don't limit it. Please don't limit it. Because we just see what trouble limiting it gets us into, right? I do. Emptiness is inherently without characteristics. Spirituality cannot be imitated. So, because the way, because the moment, because the ancestors are boundaryless and uncontained, all-pervading, the way is immediately without any abiding characteristics. It can't be imitated in that it's not an idea. It's not an action, right? It's not limited to those things. It can't be grasped intellectually, right, because it's not a concept or a thing. It's never static. It's never defined, which means it also can't be taken or given, right? Because he says in two more lines, I think, simply certify and unite with it. You can't be handed it. Right? Can I hand you this moment? I can't not hand it to you, I guess. But I sure can't hand it to you. But you can certify it. You can unite with it. You already are. He's really pulling us out of our ideas about this. He does that a lot, actually. But he's really, really... he's trying hard here to... Please pull yourself out of your ideas about this. On its own, illumination emerges from causes and conditions. So I actually had a powerful response to that line once I finally got to it. It probably took me about 3 weeks. Not really. I really liked it because what I put on that was, this was just the way I happened to read it in the moment I was reading it, but, you know, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, you know, 500 BC-ish or whatever, and I always think of, oh yes, a human finally woke up. He woke up, and it happened, and he's the one who did it. There was a thing to be done, and he was a guy, and he did it. And because of him and it, this is all happening. Oh, that's really cool, right? So he's one of our ancestors. We hold him with great respect, of course, and reverence. But what I took that to mean is, on its own, Buddha emerges from causes and conditions, which is almost funny, because it's almost like saying he gets zero credit. And if you think about it, it's true. Causes and conditions, right, are why everything arises. The conditions, the causes, were right. Things lined up in such a way that that came. And so, his life, his choices, his personal karma, his history, the way his mind worked, the way his heart worked, the decisions he made, all arose because of causes and conditions. Had those causes and conditions been a little bit different, wouldn't have happened. So, I'm being a little bit glib when I say he gets no credit. I'm very happy to give him credit. But I'm also just recognizing the nature of emptiness is such that causes and conditions. This happened. Okay. Cool. I can say that there was a person and an enlightenment and an insight and a teaching, and that those are all tracing back to him. I can say that that's true. But I can also say that none of that is actually true. So what's interesting about this is it made me think illumination emerges on its own, right? Enlightenment arises when causes and conditions are such that enlightenment arises. In other words, it's happening on its own, right? We don't do it, but it happens through us. And so it's not apart from us, right? It's us, but we're not it. So Buddha was inevitable. It was inevitable. It couldn't have not happened. Right? I mean, it did. So of course it couldn't have not. It contained everything. Yes, of course. Buddha arose. The Enlightenment arose. All things, all causes, all conditions constantly arise to create Buddha, to verify Buddha. So in Zen Buddhism, the principle of cause and effect, causes and conditions, is verified. That principle is verified, but they're also seen as being unlimited and uncontained, which means everything is both the cause and the effect of everything else. So we create Buddha with our practice. We verify Buddha with our breath, because it's not separate. It is arising. It hasn't arisen. So Buddha can't not emerge. He just can't not. And illumination, the principle, you know, we use the word Buddha oftentimes to just indicate the principle of awakening. The principle of awakening in all things, emerging on its own. And in a sense, that's just what happened with you, right? Didn't you just emerge on your own from causes and conditions? You arose, right? You're here. You couldn't have not arisen in an infinite number. If you were to try to separate them as if they were discrete events, an infinite number of discrete things had to happen in order for you. All things came together for you to arise. So you get credit, but you don't. Well done. Way to be here. Way to be in existence. Yes, yes, I feel good about it. That was a good call. I mean, yeah, it's sort of absurd in a way, right? Because causes and conditions, here we are. It's interesting because you'd think, in a sense, like emotionally, it would take away the meaning or the import of something. But at least for me, it doesn't. It just makes it all the more miraculous, almost like the entire universe decided that I really needed to be here. That didn't happen either, but it's a lot closer to that than, you know, it's an accident, nothing means anything. But it arises on its own. The reason I like this illumination emerges from causes and conditions is, to me, there's a gentleness to this. When I first came to Zen practice, like a lot of us do, and I'm glad that I came for this reason, but when I first came, I thought enlightenment is a thing. It's an experience, strictly speaking, but it's an object. And if I do the right things, I will get it. And it's up to me, which in a sense is true. I mean, Zen puts a lot of emphasis on self-effort. But if it's a thing and I have the power to get it, you can see where my mind is going, right? You can see I want, I gots to have. If I work really hard, I will get. I mean, that's a pretty acquisitive way of looking at practice. And it also gives me a goal that's forever out of my reach, right? It's always right around the corner, isn't it? It's always later. It's never now. This moment isn't whole. It's lacking something called enlightenment, right? So this 7-day session was really, really hard, and it was at best an 80% success because I didn't get the magic beans, right? And what if I did get the magic beans? What if I did have a big breakthrough experience? Fabulous. Now what do I want to do? Get it back again, ASAP, and hang on to it and make sure it never leaves. Maybe I'll have it printed on my driver's license. Wow. I know I'm being a little silly, but you get it, right? I mean, that whole thing of, like, it's right around the corner, and it'll complete you, and it'll make everything okay, and there's a thing to get, and you can do it. Get out there. I mean, this is how we normally relate to the world. We're programmed that way, right? And it's fine. I mean, it serves us well. There's a usefulness to that way, you know? If I need to get groceries, I got to go to the grocery store. But the gentleness to this teaching for me is that illumination arises on its own from causes and conditions. On its own. It is arising. It has arisen. It will arise. So when I'm sitting in Zazen, it becomes much, much less of an agenda. Got to get illuminated. You know, it just becomes much softer for me. I just need to sit. I just need to take care of this experience. I just need to see it and be kind to it. Right? Isn't that illumination arising? If that takes the form of a great experience, it'll show up when it needs to, or it won't if it doesn't. No problem. There's not a problem either way, right? Right? If the way isn't what the ancestors transmitted, it was always there, then relax. Right? Didn't it show up when it needed to? Exactly as it was supposed to? Wow, isn't that nice? If we try to practice in that spirit, I think we save ourselves a lot of trouble. Constantly living apart from surface appearances is called being the ancestor. So, we talk a lot about the ancestors in Zen, or at least it's mentioned from time to time. And they are what you would expect. As I said, they're the lineage of practitioners for 2,500 odd years. They are the lineage teachers and students. Zen is said to be passed from warm heart to warm heart. That's how the transmission happens. It's passed on from person to person, which is lovely. I think it's lovely. It's why we practice together. And the ancestors is also, I'm just aware of the cultural context of this piece. It's being written in China, and in that culture, especially at that time, there was a lot of importance placed on family, lineage, ancestors. You know, who are your parents? Who are their parents? Who are their parents? This is part of how we would self-define in those cultures. And it's also how they relate to their relatives. And we've inherited some of that here at Zen Center. I know in Japanese and Chinese culture, it's not unusual to have the ancestors spoken about and regarded in many ways as if they were still here. In some ways, they are regarded as being still here. And it's not unusual to have, even in a home, a shrine or an altar to the ancestors out of gratitude. So in the back of the Founders Hall there is an altar to the founder, right? That's why we call it the Founders Hall. The formal lineage of Katagiri Roshi, a photograph of Katagiri, an offering to Katagiri of water, and a candle, and that's to remind us he's our ancestor, right? To show gratitude and appreciation. But I also think we don't have to limit it to the idea that this is an Asian cultural artifact or it's in any way quaint, because as somebody born and raised in Minnesota, we do not have an ancestor shrine in my house. That would be odd in this culture. But this tradition has moved me in that it reminds me of my inheritance as a human. And the stuff that I take credit for, that I take for granted that I did, that when I look closely at, I have no business whatsoever taking credit for, you know. I chose to eat healthy. I chose to go to school. I chose to, really? Yeah, I did. But boy, a lot of that stuff was available to me because of the decisions of how many other people, right? Do I owe them recognition and gratitude? In my life, yeah, I do. And from a Zen point of view, of course, the ancestors is a way of just addressing the largest possible scope of inheritance of our lives as humans. The things we've eaten, the people we have known, the people who have helped us, the people who haven't. It's our biological ancestry, the biological ancestry of all the people who came into being in order for those people to come into being. It's basically everything, right? So like I said, if you could find an edge to your mind or an edge to the moment, please let me know. Same thing with this. If you can find something that isn't your ancestor, let me know. If there's something you can find that isn't included in your life, let me know. I mean, the funny thing is, I guess, when we start working with our mind in Zazen, we see how often we are patterned to exclude things from our lives. We do it all the time. Like, this is boring. This is the same wood floor I have stared at thousands of times. And I have a daydream that's much more interesting to me. I'm choosing to say no to wood floor, and I'm off. I'm off. The wood floor is not part of my experience. It's not part of my moment. It's not one of my ancestors. But I've got a really cool daydream. We do it all the time. So there's a practical level to all these instructions about how we work with our minds. And I think it feels good to acknowledge that we are standing on the shoulders of an infinite number of beings when we are sitting together. in this room breathing together. That acknowledgement is, in its truest and most helpful sense, humbling. Humbling meaning more human of the earth. It's more human to acknowledge and to see those things. Wow. In Buddhism, we call it interconnectedness, interdependence, to recognize that we're here as a result of everything. So, it's a way of acknowledging we are part of a limitlessly large community. And there's also something else that happened in this sentence that I think is interesting. He just shifted. He's very clever. Taigen and Hongzhu. I'm not sure there were even two people. But he shifted here from the ancestors in the first line to the ancestor. Constantly living apart from surface appearances is called being the ancestor. There's only one ancestor. Of course, it's you. And there's only one moment to know that. And I bet you can find it. And actually you can't, because because there is not even one moment. There is not even one. And so we become the ancestor ourselves instantly. And we do this when we release our small version of reality. We do it when we let go of our fixed views. We do it when we let go of our individual agenda. And of course, this is our practice in Zazen, right? Moment after moment after moment, the simple practice of relinquishment. We relinquish our history, relinquish our future, our hopes, our ideas, our fears. We relinquish our ancestry. We relinquish everything, really, when we choose to let go of those limited self-views, that limited narrative. It's such a simple practice that it's so easy to kind of underestimate its profundity or its effectiveness, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But it's so simple that I always find myself kind of putting it in a smaller container than it really belongs in. We become the ancestor. This is seeing through life. Not being attached in that instant that you choose to relinquish and let go is living apart from surface appearances. Right? Living apart from surface appearances. We've all been told, don't judge a book by its cover. Right? You can't tell what the person's heart is like by the way that they're dressed. That's true, right? Living apart from surface appearances in terms of letting go of the history, of the narrative, is freedom. And so we support each other. We support the ancestors when we do this, and they support us. And we also, as he is saying here, we merge with ancestor. When you really see deeply into life, you are that. And of course you are that before too, but you really merge with that ancestor and that freedom. And my caveat here is that the freedom contains suffering. Oftentimes we think freedom means nothing is wrong and I feel amazing. And that's true too. Freedom contains that too. But please don't think that freedom excludes suffering or that it's later, or else we do the same thing, right? That we're right back there again going, all right, freedom's later when I... This moment would be perfect if it... Right? That, I don't know, peace is found later when suffering is gone. I don't know how else to say that, really. We find the freedom in the suffering. Right? Suffering is not something necessarily to be rid of. It is our link to this life. It is our link to others. It is the source of our compassion. If we did not suffer, we could not have a relationship. It would be impossible for us to relate to one another as beings if we did not understand pain and suffering. Absolutely impossible. And that's a hypothetical, because no one's ever had that experience, ever, and never will. But you can sort of see, theoretically, if I'd never experienced pain and suffering, relationship would be impossible. It's actually the source of our connection to this life. It's kind of the string on our helium balloon. You know, it keeps us here. And, you know, the reason it keeps us here is because then we can be of service to self, to be of service to others. So suffering is your vow. And it helps you. It helps you to go very deeply into your life, which is where you find intimacy, right? With others, with yourself. It's where we find a connection. It's a direct path. So please be very gentle with it, but please stay, right? Don't push it away. You can allow it. So the surface of things, when we see only the surface of life, and you know what he's talking about here with the surface, right? Like, I judge you by your appearances, or the book by its cover, or I label something, or I understand it, or I basically put in my mind and heart, I put it under the category of got it, know it. Predictable, I know what you are. You're a fixed entity, a known quantity. I'm done investigating. I'm laughing because we do this with our loved ones all the time. I'm thinking especially of my wife, like, yeah, I've got her down. I know the deal, right? How often is that true? I would say like 3/4 of the time she does something more or less that I would have roughly predicted, yeah, right? Which is enough to lead me to believe I've got this down. She's a known quantity. This is. And then, of course, when she doesn't, which happens all the time, then it's like, what? What was it? What? And I don't know about you guys, but I sometimes will get mad at the person for not doing the thing I expected them to do. Like, should I have just emailed you earlier and just let you know what I wanted you to do? Because then you could have just done it. We wouldn't be having this problem. What is wrong with you? It's just, I don't know, it's just humorous. Not in the moment, sometimes. This is like retrospect. It's funny here. She's also not here this morning. That makes it funnier. But when we look at the surface of things, and which we do most of the time, and of course that shorthand that our brain does is useful to us. We need to do that. But of course practice, Zen practice is about going deeply, looking deeply, seeing through things, they sometimes say. Is about going past that. And what we start to notice is that when we see only the surface of things, everything's mundane. Isn't it? Everything's ordinary. There's nothing special. I'm sitting on a cushion. My heart's pumping. I'm breathing, I guess. I'm giving a talk. There's nothing special happening. You guys have all shown up. You're in a building. Big deal. Right? It's Sunday. Those are pretty mundane things until we start looking really deeply at all of them and going, this is, to say, awe-inspiring or miraculous falls way short. It's absolutely, literally inconceivable. Right? What's happening right now? Inconceivable. Every single thing that ever happened had to happen in order for this moment. Breathing, pumping blood, oxygen coming and going, birds coming and going, the earth rotating. I mean, wow. In other words, every single thing is mundane and ordinary when you're looking at the surface, and every single thing is holy, sacred, miraculous when you look deeply. That's really all it is. That thing, that experience, that person has no abiding qualities. You're just either looking deeply and you're willing to let it in, or you're simplifying it, looking at the surface and wanting to skip on. So again, if you can find one thing in your life that is not miraculous, bring it to me. I would love to see it. I would love to see it. I wasn't here to see Katagiri. He died before I started coming to Zen Center, but from those people who knew him and from the Dharma talks I've heard and read, I know he talked a lot about your toilet paper is Buddha. He was doing this brilliant thing teachers do of like, what's the loftiest possible thing you can imagine? Buddha. Whoa. And what's the lowliest, most ordinary, even reprehensible thing we can think of? Toilet paper. Put them together. He'd really like, pay attention. Don't use any squares you don't need. Fold it afterwards. I mean, pay, like, don't think your life doesn't include this, and don't think what you're doing right there isn't absolutely amazing, sacred, spectacular, holy, and that it contains every single thing, because it does. Wow. That's pretty cool. It's hard also to maintain that, by the way. but I think it's important. So Zazen, of course, is about looking deeply. Right? When this floor becomes boring to me, I know I've stopped engaging. I've simplified it. Because it hasn't stopped being miraculous. It's impossible for it to stop being miraculous, but here I am. I'm not really being the ancestor right now. I'm really kind of interested in moving on to the next thing. I'm settling for the Cliff's Notes version of my life. But when we allow ourselves to look deeply with our whole eye, we do become the ancestor because we are including and we're allowing and we're wisdom and compassion in that moment. We're becoming wise. We're becoming compassionate when we include. That's what the ancestor is. So, he goes on to say, all Buddhas arrive here, and they regard this as the ultimate. They respond to transformations and disperse their bodies as flowers, leaves, roots, and dusts. Wisdom enters the three times, and the 10,000 changes do not disturb us. Each dust is not outside us. So, again, he's a very tricky writer. I just love this about him. He starts this piece in the second person addressing you. And he ends it in the first person saying we and us. And he does it so sneakily you don't normally notice. It's a sneaky intimacy. It's almost like he got up off the stage and just sat down in the theater next to you and you didn't notice. But now it's us. We're all looking together. Isn't that cool? So he starts by talking to us, and he ends by talking as us. And I really like the feeling that gives me. It makes me feel like he's sitting right there, right with me. And he's so close to me that he's speaking for me. And I trust him. You know, I trust his voice. And that's actually also the ancestor. It's closer than my ideas. And closer than even my breath. So dusts are Buddha's bodies, just like flowers, leaves, and roots, and are not outside us. Some of the shorthand here I can tell you about is that the three times, when he says wisdom enters the three times is past, present, and future, usually. Yeah, the past, present, and future. So wisdom enters, it's a way of saying all times. Right. At the end of our service in the morning, you guys know we do all Buddhas, 10 directions, three times. Meaning all Buddhas in every conceivable direction in the past, the present, and the future. Everything everywhere, basically. And the 10,000 changes is, again, kind of shorthand for the infinite number of constantly arising changes. 10,000 in Chinese is, I understand, that's sort of the number they used to just mean the totality of everything, infinite. We'd say a million. I've told you a million times not to leave that screen door open. That just means I've told you an infinite number of times. The 10,000 changes. So dusts are Buddha's bodies, and just like flowers, leaves, and roots, they're not outside of us. And of course he's saying there is no Buddha that exists outside of you. There is no Buddha that exists outside of you. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Right? You guys know that one? Very same teaching. Right? And in Mahayana Buddhism, I read once that each dust mote, I'm not sure how big a mote is. M-O-T-E, not M-O-A-T. Although M-O-A-T would work here too. Each mote has a Buddha that watches over it, that takes care of it, that teaches. Each dust mote. This is what's made up. In fact, they say the same thing with the cells in your bodies. But it's just, what it really is just sort of a fantastic kind of religious image to convey to us the scope and the totality of our practice, of our actual Zazen practice. So Dogen said, when even one person at one time sits in Zazen, they become imperceptibly one with each and all the myriad things, and permeate completely all time, so that within the limitless universe, throughout past, future, and present, They are performing the eternal and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. That's a really long sentence. But it's one of my all-time favorites. It's like, this is so lofty. And Dogen, being Dogen, is a meticulous writer. He's a meticulous and brilliant, brilliant writer. So he did not mean this to be an inspirational abstraction that sounds a lot. No, he meant this literally. Like, he really meant it literally. When you sit in Zazen, you permeate completely all time. Like, I'm not kidding. Really, truly. And he says, imperceptibly, you might not perceive it, don't worry about it. You know, your perception, not the point. Like, that's actually how big of a deal this is. So that brings us to our last line. This marvel is beyond the vast thousands of classical texts. So where could you hold on to the shadowy world? It's an interesting end, isn't it? It's an interesting end. It's a very personal question he ends with. He ends with a question, and it's very intimate. Where do you hold on to the shadowy world? Shadowy, of course, just means ungraspable, right? Impermanent, fixing, changing, dreamlike. Where do you hold on to the shadowy world? I encourage you to consider this question very carefully. I really do. Ask yourself that. So, to wrap up here, to end this morning, and also to kind of prevent our practice from getting a little too lofty or too abstract, or maybe too clever, don't let your practice get clever. This piece is gorgeous, and it's also clever a little bit. So if you find any little clever, you can maybe let that go. Keep it sort of stupid. We could sum up this whole thing by saying, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. And I believe the dream is worth having. And I believe the dream is worth looking very, very deeply at, because it's you, and because it matters, and because it's very beautiful. So please do. Please do. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we do have a few minutes, I guess. If anybody has a question, comment, something they'd like to add, Kate.
There's a word in here that is a word that kind of is a button pusher for me in a lot of ways. And I'm kind of curious what the original word might have been, you know, why you chose the term. Spirituality.
Spirituality can't be imitated?
Yeah, that's a weird
It is. I actually wondered about it, too, when I first read it. And, of course, I don't know. Not knowing Chinese, I have no idea what Taigen translated into spirituality. The only way I was able to relate to it, because you're asking a good question, I don't exactly know what the spirit was behind the original, but where I took it is I watch how, you know, a lot of the stuff we learn here at Zen Center, especially traditional forms and stuff, we learn by watching. We learn by imitating, which is cool. That's how we learn. Like, oh, you do it like this and not like this, and you do, you know. We learn by imitating. That's really cool. It means you're paying attention, right? You're watching. But ultimately, what I took away is you can learn the form that way. You can learn to enter the Zendo that way. You can even memorize texts and that kind of stuff that way. But the essence of it, it can't ever be imitated, right? So because you're doing it the way Tim does it, doesn't mean you're doing it the way the ancestor does it, because you're the ancestor. Does that make sense? Well, it's not like you've got to go off and do it the opposite. That, well, maybe, but that's not the point either. It's that ultimately reality itself, and especially anything we put under the umbrella of spirituality, which is gauzy and vague at best, because I'm with you about that. so much of what we see is imitation. Oh, this is what it looks like. You know? And I don't know, I mean, that has a usefulness. There's nothing wrong with it, I guess. But yeah, there's something, at some point it becomes ingenuine. Does that sound right?
Yeah.